Good morning. Good morning, Asheville. You are listening to Asheville in the, or you will soon be listening to Asheville in the Arts, and you are listening to the new WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina at 103.7 FM on your radio dial and globally on WPVMFM.org. And on our show, Asheville in the Arts, which we've been doing for about the last 5 years, one of the things we really try so hard to do and hope it's as pleasurable for you as it is for us to do, to talk with people from our arts and cultural community here, and with the emphasis on the word local. It'd be rare, if ever, I would feature somebody who doesn't live here, has no intention of living here, and it's even regardless, though, of their accomplishments, because the talent pool or the plethora of people who are the creatives live here in Asheville. And I think they sustain and collaborate and feed off of each other equally as much as what they offer to our Asheville community. And as I want to say, today is no exception. And this discovery or this opportunity came from some folks I've worked with quite a few times now, Steve and Chris Krimi, who are Logo Sophia publishers. They're local publishers here. Google them. Logo, L-O-G-O-S-O-P-H-I-A. And Steve and Chris, I've had them on the show a couple times, and they're lovely, lovely people. And they typically also work with local writers and help them through that whole labyrinth of the world of publishing. And they've often sent me some people. And today, I'm very excited about this guest, Anya Cizak?
Ayana Cizak Blatt.
Ayana Cizak Blatt.
Got it.
And Ayana has a book that's just recently been published by Logo Sophia, those wonderful people. And we're going to talk a lot about some of the readings in public places so you can see and meet her. But I've spent, I don't know, the last couple weeks reading her book, A Tangled Tree, My Father's Paths to Immortality. And you and I were discussing before the show, your father is what I would consider contemporary to me. And even though I met him this morning on Facebook. I watched a few things that he and saw him read some things and do some things. But he's just interesting to me because I knew a lot of people like him, or well, arguably there's no one exactly like him, but who went through, let's just say, some of the same patterns and transformations. And so this, if you are a baby boomer or just on the other side of baby boomer, in other words, you were born in the 40s, and maybe if you graduated from high school in the 50s or early 60s, this is the best book for you to read, because you're going to relate to a lot of the, I don't even want to call them choices, but happenstances, and you'll relate to your dad's path. Mm. So good morning.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited about the release of this book, A Tangled Tree, and I'm just really honored to be able to share it with my local community. So thank you.
Ayana, why don't we start with two things. One, what preempted you writing this book, and then also A Tangled Tree. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those two things, and then we've got a lot to go with today to discover more about your dad, who, by the way, had a nickname, Rabbi Yahu.
Yes, Dad went by many names. Mm-hmm. And I think that his constantly shifting identity, being his daughter and looking at this man who had lived this free-spirited life, very unconventional, long tangled hair, long beard, who lived in different cities across the world as an adventure seeker, following the Grateful Dead, living on nude beaches. He started a commune in Massachusetts and a rabbi really devoted to Shabbos and to his faith. Also a very complex soul, born in 1941 on the eve of World War II, a Jewish boy on the run.
And he was born in Poland, wasn't
Poland,
he?
In Poland, it's interesting because the border kept shifting where mm-hmm. he was born. And it was actually Ukraine, but then now it's Poland. It's that territory in that time where nothing really stood still. And I have a little segment about that piece to read later. But just this kind of curiosity about who my father is, mm-hmm. especially as I grew older, started writing about him in college, wondering what has made my father live the life that he has, what has mm-hmm. propelled his life choices. And that was kind of the spark, the beginning of these short stories that helped me to realize that he had this whole history, this whole past, separate from the eccentric adult life that mm-hmm. I witnessed, mm-hmm. that I had no idea about. It was this rich, painful history tied to the Holocaust and the Second World War. And that was this big question mark, this aha, this all of this that I don't know. And then when he said to me casually over the phone one day, "I'm ready to tell my life story."
And he, at that time, you were already a writer, or you were recognized as being a writer, not just within your family, but in terms of
my community,
your community.
Mm-hmm. I was working at the Mountain Express at the time,
okay.
With Ali Marshall and Rebecca Sulock in the A&E department years ago. So that's when I started here in 2007. When I first moved to Asheville, I did the calendar and Clubland, and I also wrote articles on arts and entertainment. So I really felt lucky to be able to call myself a writer.
You're in good company.
Yeah, in great company. And when he said he was ready to tell his life story, I just said, I have to be the one to tell it, because I had already been asking these questions of who he was and where he came from. So it was like the universe kind of conspired to give me the fire to write this book as it is now.
You're one of the six children,
yes.
from five different relationships, your father.
Yes.
And your father also has a doctorate degree, a psychotherapist from Harvard. Pretty mm-hmm. good pedigree.
Yeah. Well, he graduated from the University of Chicago, but was a professor at Harvard.
Okay.
Teaching child psychology. And yes, amazing. I mean, amazing to think that those academic achievements were made despite his poverty and all of the kind of traumas of his childhood.
Also, if you Google Blatt, B-L-A-T-T effect, mm-hmm. it's very interesting, and you can read through it rather quickly, but you get some sense, too, of here's a person, I guess philosopher would certainly be an appropriate label to put on among many others, but mm-hmm. he was creative, he was a philosopher, certainly a deep thinker. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the kind of person who, if you said it, was just going to buy it. He would be somewhat, I would think, analytical and would want to examine it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's a generation, too, that finally, after World War II, maybe that's when people started realizing, I think anyway, they had a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
The wars taught us life can be short.
Mm-hmm.
The wars also taught us, if you're not going to do it now, when are you going to do it? There was a sense of immediacy outside of a war thing that I think seeped into how we're starting to choose our lives. So your dad's a real good example. I can't resist using words like hippie, beatnik. Those were mm-hmm. terms that were there, and your dad may have fallen into that category. Fair enough.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
By casual observers,
mm-hmm.
and so talk a little bit about your dad, and then in terms of the biography of who this man was, and tell us his name.
Yes, yeah. Michael Moshe Blatt, and by many other names, Rabbi Yahu. And he you know, lived so many different incarnations in one lifetime. And that's part of why this story, I think, is so dynamic, because he goes from this refugee to this young professor to someone just swept up in the intrigue of the 70s and the psychedelic movement of opening your mind and your soul to healing beyond this reality. And that really shifted his life. And then from there, the LSD intrigue kind of morphs to a more nomadic existence of traveling, of being untied from the the watch and the clock and the job, and instead kind of living a more free life. And I'd be happy to read a
Yes,
a
please. And tell us the title of your book again.
Yes, it's A Tangled Tree, My Father's Path to Immortality. And I call it A Tangled Tree because really there are six kids from five women. It's the story not only of myself and my siblings and our tie to my father, but also my father's complex and beautiful relationship with his parents. And there's a reimagining of their story during the war that's really, you know, beyond my lifetime. So I reimagine it. And that's the second book within a book, so to speak, of really kind of embodying their life. Mm-hmm. But I'll read a few small memories or short memories of mine as a child traveling with my father. From a very early age, I am aware that my father is different. He sets himself apart both deliberately and obliviously. His clothing, short and torn, his enchanting Eastern European accent, his long, tangled brown hair and wise man's beard, his stories and life philosophies, his faith, his peculiar healing diet and lifestyle, a veiled but ferocious temper. There is both a bright spark of light that illuminates his soul and a dark shadow that flickers in his eyes. My childhood memories of Dad are sensory saturated. When I think of my travels with him as a small girl from the ages of 3 to 11, I am flooded with the sensations of the places he took me. The strange scenes, smells, tastes, and feel of our summers together come back to me. Closing my eyes, I find myself a child again, swept up in Dad's extraordinary adventure. In one memory, I'm running behind my father on Secret Beach, his favorite place to camp when he's on Kauai, where he lives as a beach bum, liberated from Babylon.
That's he's in Hawaii, isn't
in Hawaii.
It?
Okay. He is perpetually naked, his flat butt jiggling as he sprints ahead of me. I am wearing a bright pink bathing suit, chasing him as he howls and zigzags across the sand. Wind knots my hair, and my laughter propels me forward. I am wild, tangled, free. In another memory, I am 6 years old, living in Jerusalem, and I remember peeling beets in a white dress. I'm on the front porch looking out at a clock tower perched in central Jerusalem. As I peel, beads of red soak into fabric. My father sits beside me in our home in the Holy Land and tells me this is where our people belong. Did you know, he says, that I lived here when I was a boy, on the other side of the country by the sea in a city called Haifa? I can still see his olive green eyes, his chestnut brown hair, his hands wide and open in his lap. We were very poor, he tells me. We ate bread with garlic, and my mother, your bubby, would say, close your eyes and it will taste like beef. You see, we had no money for more. Tears fall into my father's open hand. I listen, not fully understanding the story he's offered, and continue to peel. The red stains in the white dress will never be undone. One more short memory.
Sure.
I'm 7 years old in the back of a milk truck turned funked up Winnebago with my father at the wheel as we chase the Grateful Dead across North America. Myself, Dad, and a new girlfriend, a blonde woman with piercing blue eyes, and the husky dog Bear all live in the back of the Bago, as we call it. Mm-hmm. The highway is wide open and empty, but Father drives slowly, cautiously. His girlfriend is in the passenger seat rolling a joint, which they pass back and forth before rolling another. I'm in the back with the dog, sitting in a cloud of marijuana smoke as we creep across the freeway. At the show, the lights are enchanting and a little terrifying. They swivel and twirl across the massive crowd, and adults act like they're children again, uncoordinated, exuberant, throwing their limbs madly as they move. It's a sea of psychedelic people, skeletons, blood-red roses, beards, wildly tossed hair, and tie-dyed shirts, stretching far in all directions. Everyone is dancing. The songs never seem to end.
Wow. What order are you in of the six siblings? Are you?
I'm the fourth, and okay. I spent every summer with my father, and so we would take these epic adventures, our summer adventures, and that's where I really learned that with father comes this freedom and this exploration and also this intensity mm-hmm. and this lack of stability.
Were other siblings joining you then as well? Or
no, my mother really, out of all of the siblings, was the one that said, okay, well, you chose him to have your adventure, know your father, and come back safe.
Yeah, where was your mom living, or you would have been living during the yes. school year, so to speak?
In Hawaii, in Kauai.
Oh, wow, what an yeah. interesting existence.
I know.
Yeah.
So base with mama for the school year, and then these adventures with my father
you
every summer.
You grew up barefooted.
I did.
How wonderful, how yeah. wonderful. In the process of writing this memoir of your father, and it's kind of sprinkled with what I guess would be called magical realism and certainly creative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Often when we read literature, we expect conflicts, memoirs being a little bit different. But your father, almost as he worked with you, but when the book was finished, there's this whole concept of he wishes you would have written two books,
mm-hmm.
and he had some problems with what you wrote. Tell
yeah.
us about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it, or I could also read a scene that is really about the heart of that conflict.
Okay.
It's a shorter scene.
And again, with me today is Ayana. Please say
Ayana.
Your name. Ayana. And Ayana's
ions, like science.
Okay, Ayana. And her book is A Tangled Tree about her father. And it is prominently displayed as we speak in the wonderful bookstore called Malaprops over there on Haywood.
Yes.
So check it out.
And please join me if you're available on Saturday, June 3rd at 7 for the grand opening, the official launch.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, yeah.
That would be great. Okay, so
Thank
tell
you.
Us a little bit about why your dad's thinking
conflict.
There should be two books or this conflict.
Right, and I think that this conflict is really propels the story forward and creates another level of the complexity. And here's a scene that really focuses on that. And it's in Thailand when I travel to go see him and I show him a rough draft of the book and he has a chance to really encounter a raw version of this book. It's changed a lot since then, but he encounters the material for the first time. I asked you to write my life story, mine. That's all I asked you to do. I turn away, looking out into a crystal blue sea. Monsoon clouds swell on the horizon, dark thunderheads gathering close. Look here, he says, pointing to a sentence. He reads it out loud. My father is a runner. That's what you wrote. Those are your words, not mine. I didn't ask for your judgments on me. I didn't ask for your opinions. Though I'm prickling with anxiety, my words are steady. How can I separate myself from this story, Dad? I'm a part of it. I am no runner. His Eastern European accent makes each word heavy. They fall, leaden from his lips. Ayana, you've painted me as a monster, as a maniac who abandoned his children. Moshe's eyes dart back and forth, wild, green, and uneasy. As for my past and my mentors, I must admit you've done well. One hand rests on the paper, palm covering the page. Another is pressed to his heart. It moves me, he says. However, when it comes to my wives, my children, and me, your perspective is totally false. The way you see me, the way you write about me, I'm nothing but a demon. My father looks at me, thick creases of sorrow framing his face. I will not put my name on it. No, never. Not unless it's totally changed. His words roll over me as I stare, watching a wall of rain push closer. I turn to my father. This book is about both of us. It's about the process that brought us close again. Dad, I'm the author. I have an equal stake in this. What would you have me do? Throw myself out and start again? I want two books, he snarls. Separate books. One about my childhood as a Holocaust survivor, my loving parents, and our journey from Poland to Israel. He pauses, scowls, and continues. Book one will be about my mentors, PhD, professorship at Harvard, and my accomplishments as a psychotherapist. Are you listening to me? My eyes are focused on limestone islands off the shore, slowly being swallowed by gray. A sharp wind rushes towards us. My father takes a drag. The end of his cigarette burns hot beside me. In the second book, you can write about the mothers who stole my children. I don't want them anywhere near my parents' story. They are not worthy of it. He looks at me, eyes ablaze. There, Ayana, you can judge me all you like. You can rip me apart. He takes a breath. As a father, I'm done. Do you hear me? I'm retiring. I release you to your life. I collect my book's pages from my father's hold. My words stare back at me, an unblinking pattern of black against white, and my heart beats hot and panicked. Have I betrayed him? My father's words are shards of broken shells, angrily aimed and piercing. To him, in turn, my written words are sharp as blades, bearing down with vengeance and judgment. There is a fast, blustering wind around us and a torrent of rain only moments away. Smoke swirls from my father's mouth. I am disappointed in you. I asked you to write my life story. That's all I asked you to do. I see his anger. I see his agony, and I hold my words tight. The storm is coming. The storm is here.
Wow. Wow. Nicely written. And did you make any changes as a result of that conversation, I guess?
Conflict, right.
Conflict
with
your dad?
What I did do is, with that reflection and then with the help of a trusted reader, I really did my best to strip down any unnecessary judgment or criticism mm-hmm. of father that I might have put in there because of my own wounds mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as a daughter who felt in the shadow of this eccentric soul. Mm-hmm. And so in stripping down unnecessary judgment and just letting him lift up as a character more and speak for himself and let his words be what we read, and then mm-hmm. also let my perspective stand, but less judgmental, mm-hmm. kind of moments, but more just perspectives standing side by side, then I think it allows the reader to really make a decision for themselves on who we are mm-hmm. as people, as the family dynamic, of what is this story about. So I do think it's a more balanced piece, but I still think in many ways that dad faces judgment in this story that's hard, mm-hmm. as anyone does when reviewing their life and someone else's opinion of how it impacted them. So mm-hmm. there's that conflict still.
Well, because the reader brings their point of view, and from their point of view, they're going to make their assessment judgments and go from there. I mean, you'll have people who will strongly identify with this book and cheer him on, and you'll have others who say, how dare he, how could he, then they'll use all kinds of words. So I don't think you have no one has control over that in terms of you've got to let it go mm-hmm. and see where it lands, so to speak. Also curious to siblings' reaction. Have they yeah. read this book, and yeah. what are their thoughts?
Well, you know, it's so funny because I had spent so much energy, mental space worrying, oh my God, what is everyone going to say? And I had to put those worries aside and just write it. But it doesn't mean it didn't keep me up at night. And I expected strong reactions, but one thing I didn't expect is that my siblings might not be so eager to read it in the first mm. place. So that was kind of a surprise, but I don't blame them either. I think this story and what I have to say might be terribly intimidating to open the first page even. But my little sisters, my younger sisters, have been very supportive of the work. And I think it's just hard. I think the subject of father is hard for the siblings in different ways and for different reasons. And so there's a resistance perhaps to the material because of the personal pain mm-hmm. or love or, complexity that we each hold and carry.
And I imagine those reactions would be very similar to other readers. One is this, is there one who's really very really rah-rah cheering you on, or have you had some others encountered some negativity from them, or maybe it has changed now, your relationship with and to them?
That is going to still yet to be seen. Okay. Yeah, the book officially launches in bookstores and in libraries independent in June 1st.
Okay.
And so we had a digital kind of release where people could purchase it from Logo Sophia or from my site, but now that it's at Malaprops and at local bookstores and at some libraries, we'll see. Now that it's really kind of coming into the world, we'll see what that reaction is like from my family. And I'm eager to hear. Part of me also is terrified to hear, but I really want it to spark conversation.
And I think it will. I think it will. It's a great read, especially for people who are on either side of what this the whole society of the 60s, 70s represented, or to get an insight to, I think, your grandparents, perhaps, for some, depending on your age, of these were their when I say the word struggles or their sufferings, because I think people from that generation of which I'm a part and your dad is, there were a lot of choices for us to make, and whether, and there always is, but these were choices unlike previous generations were making. Whether they made the choices consciously or unconsciously, or maybe a little bit of each, I don't know. It's interesting to expand, because some of the things that your dad was choosing to do maybe today aren't as big a deal. Like smoking marijuana, I mean, we have, what, 8 or 9 states in this country who have legalized it.
Yeah.
So, and it's not unusual, and back then, it was just those people who were doing it. It wasn't something, and kind of just taking off like that. But I just found it so interesting because he obviously was definitely established as a person who, had he continued down that same path of the academic and the psychotherapist and writing and so on, who knows? But then again, I don't know. It's just interesting because often people who've reached that point would not have made the same decisions your dad did.
A left-hand turn.
A left-hand turn, yeah.
And I think in part that turn came from his own desire to heal from his traumas as a boy born into genocide. And that the generation at the time of this exploring your soul through psychedelics, about opening your mind and seeing what else was in there beyond linear understanding, was a big part of the generation that also gave him that possibility to turn left here. And he did. And I think he did so because he found that beneath, you know, the robes of academia, his soul was in need of something deeper, and something like to the core of his being needed to be shaken and woken. And that's really what I think propelled it, is the drugs helped him. He calls it the medicine, helped him to access some of the deeper feelings inside him that he had bottled up.
Yeah. Folks, I want to remind you, you're listening to the new WPVM 103.7 FM here in Asheville, North Carolina. This is Asheville in the Arts, and I'm your host, Carol, and with me this morning is Ianya. I have this real hard issue. I guess I got to take myself off the radio. Pronounce your name for us.
No, it's a hard one. Ianya. Ianya Czek-Blatt. I mean, that's like the hardest name possible.
And she is with us, and just Asheville resident for, I don't know, how many years now?
Since 2007.
Okay. And her current book, is this your first book published?
My first book.
First book published by Logo Sophia. And tell us the title again.
A Tangled Tree, My Father's Path to Immortality.
Is with us. And why don't we do this at the half hour right now? You've got a couple places you're going to be reading.
Yes.
And obviously signing books for people. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of Q&As afterwards. So tell us, what are you going to be doing the next couple weeks and where?
Thank you so much. I would be so grateful to share this with the community and person. And please come if you're able to Malaprops on Saturday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. for the official book launch. I'm so grateful for Malaprops for their support. So that's Saturday, June 3rd at 7. I have a reading and a community discussion at Congregation Beth Israel that's open to the public on Sunday, June 11th at 5 p.m. And then I have a reading at the end of the month at Firestorm Books on Sunday, June 25th at 6 p.m. And I would be so grateful to have a dialogue and a chance to share in this community.
And those events are free.
They're all free.
And do you have a website or something that might direct people there?
Yes. My website is my name, Ayanna Czak Blatt.
Spell it.
It's AyannaCzak. BLATT.com. You can also look up A Tangled Tree, My
that
Father's Path to Immortality. And I would be so grateful for people to come and join the discussion with me.
You are. I found you to be a very warm and open person, just our pre-show chat, and very inviting to that. I want to make one other comment about the prose, the way you write really beautifully. You write, it's almost like you're writing as if you were painting. You really create, when you're talking, you're in Hawaii or when you're in Thailand, I'm starting to feel the heat. I'm starting to feel the humidity. I'm picturing those cliffs you all were climbing at beaches.
Mm-hmm.
You write very cinematically, and it's a pleasure. It's, you're a good read.
Thank you.
And I really enjoyed it very much. Very flowing, without like run-on sentences. It's crisp. It's clean. You were always with you.
Thank you.
When you're writing. So I appreciate that, because I think that's a gift and an art. You also have on the cover of your book, it's a black and white kind of a picture of this two sides of this man I see here. And but there's also a picture of, is that stone a lapis?
It's a lapis stone.
And it's a blue. It kind of pops out. Yeah. What's the significance of that?
The lapis stone is symbolic of the pain that my grandmother ingests from her experience as a survivor, as someone who loses her entire family to the Holocaust. So the stone is a physical stone, but it's also symbolic of the pain that she consciously ingests and holds within her. It's, she refuses to let go. I have a scene a little bit about my grandmother, but you had mentioned earlier, Carol, about the generation that's so, being so close to the war. For my grandmother, it defined her soul thereafter. She was never the same. She really lost faith in her fellow man, her fellow mankind. My grandfather lost faith in God. So between the two of them, she kept prayer alive, but he really was distrustful of people. So they were forever touched by and forever scarred and traumatized from what they endured. And that stone is a metaphor for that pain that is lodged into our bones. And the cover is meant to be half a portrait of my father and half a portrait of me. So it is the idea that together we are creating this story, and that we're inseparable. Again, that conflict that I read about in Thailand, that it's our story and that it really cannot be disconnected. But I'd love to share, I have just a little bit about my grandparents, because my grandparents, I feel, are huge, huge players in this story. It's from them that, you know, they passed down so much of the Jewish soul that my father identifies with, and his sense of faith is so deeply rooted to them and also to their pain. So if it's all right, I'll read a scene. And this is in Asheville, and I'm trying to step into them from A Tangled Tree. A barking crow sits beside me, a trickster calling out. 6 weeks have passed since Dad left Asheville, and I find it hard to concentrate this morning, with last night's dream pasted to the back of my eyelids, with the call of this bird flooding my mind. But still, I force myself to face the most challenging aspect of this story. my father's childhood. His first years in the world have colored him like a dye, an inky blue twilight, an indigo foreboding, a tempestuous tint that lingers behind the surface of his being. These years are the most distant from me, the most obscure, and yet I know they are the most impactful of all. Stepping into the past, however, means confronting two people greatly removed from me, people who shared my blood and name, but not my language. My grandparents, my father's beloved keepers, the people who fled while others called them fools, spoke Yiddish, Hebrew, Polish, and Russian. Like bubbles, their words would float, sounding all the same, translucent, bursting into nothingness around me. I spent only days with them in my lifetime, and with only a few words of English to cling to, we were forced to find other ways to speak. When I remember my father's mother, my father's father, I find them locked in their home, safe only inside the borders of their own existence. I reach for them because they carry all that I will never know, the secrets of my lineage, the courage, fear, and fate that's carried me here and continues to pulse through the veins beneath my skin. I grasp for every memory because, though few, they are all I will ever have. In them, to my surprise, I find that I know more than I ever thought I could. My boobie spins inside her home, a top that's always in motion, with a thousand things to do. Long, gray and black streaked hair is tied tightly into a bun at the back of her head, a crown of fine strands released only in private, seen only by the man to whom she is devoted. Bulbous and round, her body protrudes, her neck a band of flesh beneath her chin, her belly imposing. Her skin is pale, the color of skim milk, just a little blue, sweaty yet cold. Beady dark eyes observe, focusing on all that needs to be done. As a girl visiting with my father, I trail behind her, following the hem of her faded yellow dress as it brushes over the floor. She wears a beige apron wrapped around her waist, and I must follow her quickly or I will lose her. "Now we are kneading the sugar for the sweet," she says. She reaches into her apron and pulls out a key. "Go down to get, we go down," she says, playful in a stern way. I follow her into the basement where a naked bulb burns and illuminates the cluttered, dusty cave below. Magazines and newspapers are stacked from wall to ceiling. Beneath blankets, stained pillowcases, shoes, suitcases, rusting tools, buckets of nails, a winding path curves through the chaos. We walk through the narrow pass. Bobby's stride is confident, having created the tight passage herself, and she maneuvers confidently, snaking past books, ropes, a bent bicycle, the disassembled parts of an old washing machine. Between the bag of barley, cornmeal, chickpea flour, and powdered milk, here, she's found the sugar. We return the way we came, navigating the serpentine maze. My grandmother has kept everything that might, in her eyes, be useful, necessary even if disaster strikes. Always to save, just in case, she tells me as we climb the stairs to the kitchen. Always to save, because war can find her at any moment, because life has left her hungry and cold, has warned her to prepare for the potential catastrophe looming over the day.
Wow. And Booby, or your grandmother, was one constant, wasn't that, in your father's life?
Yes.
I mean, I remember reading a passage where, was it every 2 weeks or something, he would call them from wherever?
Mm-hmm.
And are they living, or were living in Toronto, is that correct? Or?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Toronto. After the war, they went to Israel. They returned to Poland first and realized there was nothing for them there except mm-hmm. ghosts and sorrow. And they went to Israel, and they were some of the first refugees to live in Israel at the dawn of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And then after maybe, I think, 5 or 6 years in Israel, my aunt, so my father's older sister married a man who had been in Auschwitz, but his family had enough money to bring his new bride, my aunt, and her family, all of them, to Toronto.
Wow.
So they got a ticket from this man who said, let's start over, come with me. Mm-hmm. And they all lived in Monique's house, a one-bedroom house with an attic. So everyone was upstairs until they could save enough for their own apartment, and then eventually save up for this little house that my grandmother got that she packed full of stuff, attic to basement, just food, random pieces of junk that to her were necessary. Yeah. And it symbolized security. Having a home, having these things meant that she would be okay.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like your father really clinged to that sense of Judaism, or being a Jew meant something to him, but it doesn't sound like he would have necessarily been a practitioner. Does that make sense? And I don't want to discount it, because that obviously informed who he is.
Yeah, and it did. I think that he is a little boy hearing stories of all of the people he lost that he would never have. He'd never have access to their great wisdom. And so much of that wisdom, from my grandmother's perspective, was knowledge of our Jewish history, of our Jewish texts, all that he lost. So early on, he was aware of this connection that was severed unfairly. And I think that also with Shabbos, the lighting of the candles every Friday night as a constant memory in his childhood, and then in mine, being his daughter, was something he felt he needed to pass down always, to honor his parents, to honor everyone that had died. It felt, I think, like a religious experience, but also a spiritual obligation instilled in him before he even knew that he needed to do so.
Didn't he meet your mother in connection with
Shabbos? Yes, that's how they met. They met in his commune home on a Friday night.
Where would that have been in?
In Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
The Brighton House, where our Friday night doors were always open. And that was one of the really beautiful practices with my father. Wherever we were, we made Shabbos. But at the Brighton House, we had a big table, beautiful tablecloth, silverware, and everyone came. We had people come just for the food who were homeless in the community, but were always welcomed and could spend the night, could eat and sleep. And we had people, you know, sitting next to them that were wearing pearls and that were, you know, people who had plenty of abundance in the financial world, but all sitting side by side for this ritual. And my father, that's really where he came to life and would shine, because his heart would just open. He would cry openly. He would pray and sing beautifully. Actually, on my website, at the bottom, you can listen to a track of music that he recorded, old Yiddish and Hebrew lullabies.
Wow.
And it's very beautiful. But his song, his voice has always carried that passion and love for his parents. So that's where they met. And I can see how, you know, one would be most drawn to him in that moment when he's just so open.
Did your father, I'm guessing they spoke Polish or Yiddish or both?
He he speaks Polish and Yiddish and Hebrew. I don't. So it's, you know, it's something I wish I had had the more time with him. Just the summers, I think, weren't enough to really integrate the language.
Tell us a little bit about the process of writing this book. I thought was interesting. How did you put it all together? Because you had basically just one major source to draw from. I don't know if you interviewed other spouses or other siblings, but what was it like to, how did you put this all together?
Well, I had gone to Canada and interviewed my aunts about their memories from the war. And that was a really amazing conversation, because they were just bickering the whole time. No, you remember it wrong. I remember better. I was older, let me tell you, this is how it was. And so they were just bickering, and I didn't know what truth was. But that was also kind of beautiful too, because what is truth? It's our memory of how it was, and that's true. But in the end, I decided that if I asked anyone else other than my father or myself, then it would just be too messy. I would have to ask everyone, and I wouldn't know where to begin. So I really tried to use information that I had from them to kind of fill in the pieces of where and what and details that my father didn't share with me. So I tried to integrate things that I knew without asking anyone for confirmation, and then just really sticking with my father, my father's perspective, and my own, because otherwise I don't think I would have been able to have enough focus, mm-hmm. if
but
that makes
didn't
sense.
You and your father spend a month together?
We did.
Was that here in Asheville?
That was here in Asheville,
oh, okay.
in a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment in Montford that I was renting with no porch and no backyard.
Oh, wow.
My father really hated the idea of sleeping indoors, mm-hmm. but we were in this two-story apartment with no outdoor space. Mm-hmm. But it was also this kind of tiny, kind of comical time capsule, because here we are after years of distance, like stepping on each other to get to the bathroom and get to the kitchen, and all of a sudden sharing this tiny, tiny space. So we spent 1 month there.
Were you taking notes, tape recording, or how did that?
I used an audio digital recorder.
Okay.
So everything is on an MP3. Mm-hmm. And then I took notes by hand, but I didn't want the stress of having to capture everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back, and that's where I could pick up, oh, I love the way he said this. And I transcribed hundreds of pages. And then after the transcription is when the stitching of the scenes kind of came in, of how do I create layers that fit together? Where do I step in to say mm-hmm. something? But our kitchen table in Montford is kind of like the anchor. We return there. We're fighting. We're cooking. We're bickering. We're laughing. We're cooking food. That's kind of a base throughout mm-hmm. the book, is that we return to that little time capsule in Montford.
And then after you stitched it together, because it goes somewhat chronologically, doesn't it, in time, I mean, telling the story. Then you, to finish it off, you went to Thailand. I'm not sure, what was that, where your dad was? Or
Dad, at the time, was living in India and in Thailand.
Oh.
So he had to renew his visa every 6 months. Mm-hmm. So he had to go from India to Thailand to renew the visa.
Oh, okay.
So he spent his years abroad. And that's in part why we didn't have much of a relationship mm-hmm. for my high school and college years, is because he moved to India. And that was...
That's a big trip to make.
And also
whatever.
Communication was mm-hmm. hard. We'd have an internet cafe, like a Skype date, mm-hmm. but it would always cut out.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't really good at writing emails because his eyesight. So we just really couldn't connect in that mm-hmm. time. So I went to Thailand in part because I was like, what is my dad doing living in the Far East? Like, what is his life like? And I want to go
sure.
and see. And then also have an opportunity to bring my pages
mm-hmm.
and to have some time again. I had imagined it more like Asheville, where it would have been an easier experience. But mm-hmm. as that earlier scene suggests, it was very difficult because he felt very betrayed by my perspective. I don't think he expected me to have such a role in the story. And I felt equally hurt and betrayed and paralyzed by his anger. But I wrote to one of my teachers at the time, and I said, oh my God, all of this is happening. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher wrote back and was like, I know that this is emotionally intense for you, but it's perfect. This is what your book needs. Like, write it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those weeks thereafter, I started seeing all of that as the ending, as the book mm-hmm. itself.
'Cause sometimes books are hard to end. Writers often have the dilemma, when do I stop?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that you had probably a lot of material you didn't use. It might assume maybe that other second book your dad was always looking forward to. Do you have any other things in process now?
My life right now as a writer is just kind of journaling, and I write for work and mm-hmm. I write for Mother Earth News, but it's mostly like how-tos and, mm-hmm. Gardening and permaculture, and then I write for my job. But creative writing has kind of been at a pause. Going from this epic story to mm-hmm. what next is a really big question. So yeah. I guess I'm figuring out what is my next, what is the next story? And I hope I tease with my mother that it's going to be something light, like Honeybees and Babies.
Has your mom read the book?
She has.
What's her reaction?
I think the book, she's very proud of me. I mean, she's my mother. She's like my biggest mm-hmm. cheerleader and advocate. And mm-hmm. I'm very lucky because whatever it is, I have her support.
Do you have other siblings other than what would be tied back to your dad?
With my mother, yeah. I'm the only one.
Okay,
so
great.
I get love all it. Of that love.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that aside from all of the support and love, that there of course is some, because my father speaks negatively about her, and mm-hmm. and I think there's hurt there, as there's hurt with right. anyone who's a part of this story. Hurt and hope and love, all of it combined. So, I mean, overall, she supports me no matter what, but I think that, of course, it's hard for her, too, as yeah. it's hard for, I imagine, any of the mothers of his children reading this story.
Yes, he did. He somehow just doesn't have good relationships with women, and I think there's probably some reasons why, but or lots of reasons, I guess, people would fall yeah. into. If you had it to do over again, this whole process, what are some ahas or things you might have done differently?
Yeah.
Or think, wow, I really hit it yeah. right where I wanted it to be.
Well, that is a huge question just because it took me so long mm-hmm. to get here. I think that I really wanted to finish. Mm-hmm. And if I could go back to that younger writer that was beginning, I would say, you will finish, but patience, mm-hmm. slow, steady patience, just be present, because I had this drive to finish and this drive to, you know, find a publisher, find a completion to the process, and then years of editing between the final product and the first draft. So that process, I would have just encouraged myself to slow down. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, gosh, that took you so long, you know, 7 years. And a part of me feels like, but sometimes it takes that long.
Yeah.
So I guess it would have just been, you know, just trust time and yeah. trust yourself and trust the process. Mm-hmm. Don't be so anxious. Just trust.
Yeah. I assume you sent some copies to your dad.
I did,
who's
yes.
He's now in, is it Grass Valley, California?
He's in Grass Valley, California. And he also, he's between California and his boat in the Hawaii, Niwiliwili Harbor, where he's a lone sailor with his, mm-hmm. he has a recording studio and he sings. And at nighttime, you can hear his chanting throughout the harbor. And he, I do think he's a little isolated on the harbor, mm-hmm. but I'm grateful that he has his boat.
Well, you know, I think there's another chapter yet to be told. It's going to be in part based on the reaction to this book, I think, and some of the comments you're going to receive, particularly from people who know your family or are part of your family. Mm-hmm. And I think your journey's just beginning in some sense. Mm. You know, publishing is only, you're only 50% of the way there, I think.
It's true. But I'm so grateful to be able to share it with you mm-hmm. today. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Tell us again some of the places that we can see you. And I really encourage you to go and meet her. She's lovely and charming. And I think you'll enjoy the process and the reflection in it. So where are you going? Where are you going to be the next couple of weeks here
right.
in Asheville?
Well, I'm going to be at Malaprops on Saturday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. And Malaprops has a beautiful display of the book. Thank you, Malaprops, for your support. So that's Saturday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. And I'll have wine and something sweet to offer. And it's free and open to the community. Congregation Beth Israel on Sunday, June 11th at 5 p.m.
And that's
open
on,
to the public.
Is that on Murdoch?
Yes.
Okay.
It's Beth Israel Synagogue. The congregation has mm-hmm. a beautiful community room. And it's open to the public, but I'm really excited to mm-hmm. be able to share. And then Firestorm Books on Sunday, June 25th at 6 p.m.
That's on Haywood Road.
On Haywood mm-hmm. Road. And check out A Tangled Tree online, My Father's Path to Immortality. And you should find more on my website, IannaCzakBlatt.com.
Great. Tell me, do you interact very much with some of the writers we have here in Asheville? I think we have many, many outstanding writers, and maybe we just need more readers for writers. But do you interact with any of the writing groups or
yes,
others?
Well, I have the Great Smoky Mountain Writing Program.
The Tommy Hayes, I
yes,
love him.
And
in that program.
That program helped me so much because I signed up for 3 workshops mm-hmm. through Great Smoky Mountain Writing when mm-hmm. I was in the throes of this. Mm-hmm. And I told the professors there, I just said, you know, if it's all right, I'm going to do my best to get through the assignments, but really what I'm trying to do is create pages on this personal project. Mm-hmm. And every single person, every teacher there was like, yes, go, girl.
Tell us,
you know,
who some
it.
Of the folks you worked with
yes,
over at Greater Smokies.
I took 2 workshops with Lenny Zumas, mm-hmm. And she's now in Portland, Oregon, teaching mm-hmm. at the University of Portland. Mm-hmm. She wrote some really quirky, cool books of her own, but she was a teacher there, and she focused on quirky nonfiction and fiction writing. And then I took a course with Sebastian Matthews, poet at Warren Wilson College. And he was actually the teacher that wrote to me that said, you know, I know this is a painful time in Thailand, my father's reaction, but this is the material that you want. Mm-hmm. And so those relationships lasted even after the courses. Nice. Yeah. So I just feel grateful because also there's so many great writers in our community, and having a chance, I think, to connect with others in their creative process rather than just being alone in your studio or your den, it's really essential as a writer. And so I'm grateful for that program because you can find community.
Yeah, and I think every now and then, even the best of the best has to be encouraged, sometimes has to go to somebody else who just gets it and understands them and maybe can give them a tip or a pointer or just listening ears, an open heart. So it is a great community here. Who are some of your favorite writers?
I have some contemporary writers who I love. I love Jonathan Safran Foer's books. He wrote Everything is Illuminated and most recently Here I Am. He also wrote a book, Eating Animals, about, you know, about just what it means to be eating animals in our world. But he's a really great writer. And Alice Hoffman, I adore her. There's this one book of hers, The Dove Keepers, where she reimagines the women of Masada and ancient Israel. And she's just a magical writer. I love Isabel Allende and Garcia Marquez, just because magic realism is, as you can probably tell
from your book, yes.
And I love Dara Horn. She is an amazing writer who also steps into a world of kind of magic thinking. I think that's the writing I'm most drawn to, is that they take a little bit of creative liberty to pair the metaphysical and the real world together, because I don't believe that they're that separate. Those things
I don't either.
Can happen here.
I don't either. Well, it sounds like you've affirmed what I maintain is the best writers are also the best readers. No. They read. They tend to read very, very intentionally, but very. I mean, you're never without a book.
Yeah.
Or maybe two or three are, you know, at a nightstand in this room, that room. And because reading other people's things obviously informs you.
Yeah.
And we learn from that. And then there must be experiences, too, like, wow, will I ever be able to write like that?
Yeah.
Or, oh, my gosh. If he only did this. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun. Well, folks, I'm so delighted you could join us on Asheville in the Arts this morning. And with me is my guest,
Ayanna Cizak Blatt.
And go see her next Saturday over at Malaprops. And the title of her book is
A Tangled Tree, My Father's Path to Immortality. Thank you so much, Carol.
It's really been a pleasure. And I want to remind folks that we'll trade off on your old network there at Mountain Express. If you go online to Mountain Express, just Google it or pick up a copy. This is a big holiday weekend coming up on us with Memorial Day. We're going to be celebrated on Monday, or at least day off for many. If you'll just check in with them, they can give you a whole bunch of things that are out there to do. Some are free, some are ticketed events, but I think Asheville will do itself proud this weekend. Any bands and groups that you particularly like here in Asheville or follow?
I feel like, I have been a little out of touch of the musical world these days, just between all of my endeavors, but so many. I mean, this city, we are so blessed to have so many different venues.
What do you and your pal there, your partner there, what do you like to do for fun?
Oh, well, we are homesteaders. We have honeybees. Well, I'm the honeybee keeper, I keep bees. We have goats and chickens, a big annual garden and a perennial garden bed. And I think it really helps me to get away from the computer, get away from my mind and be outside. I think that sometimes this creates the space for some of my best thinking and moments of integration. So I love being out in the honeybee hive. I love gardening and and I love working with plants.
Super.
That's a big hobby.
You know, by the way, somebody told me we have over 200 miles of trails with just within, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 miles of Asheville. So if you just Google hiking trails, Asheville, North Carolina. So if you're looking for something to do this weekend, speaking of outdoors, there's so many wonderful trails, places you can go. And I think weather might allow you to do that this weekend. Yeah. So check it all out. Folks, I want you to stay tuned for our syndicated show and remind you that you have been listening to the new WPVMLP here in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 FM on your dial, and globally at WPVMFM.org. Please stay tuned for our syndicated show. Let's see, I've instructed you to stay tuned for our syndicated show, and I'm in the process of bringing that up for you, so please bear with me. Wow. Yikes, where am I? And let's go down here to...